He's 92 years old now, but back in 1944 in Normandy, he was a paratrooper with a very unique assignment.
You were indoctrinated. That was part of the training.
Right.
That you were better than anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And you could do it.
You'll hear what he did and his very legitimate reason for turning down a Purple Heart. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join me for Hometown Heroes today at 1 on News Talk 580 or 5 p.m. on FM 105.9 KMJ.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday here on News Talk 580 KMJ. That's when you hear the show at 1 o'clock. You can catch it at 5 o'clock on FM 105.9 and anytime on KMJNow.com online worldwide. Each week we visit with veterans of World War II. The idea is first and foremost to honor them for their service, for the sacrifices they've made on our behalf. We want to preserve their stories so they're not forgotten, and I'm pretty sure that each one of us learns a thing or two along the way. And we're going to take that journey today with 92-year-old Robert Barney of Fresno, California. 92 years old. You wouldn't know it by shaking his hand or hearing some of his stories, which we're going to get to right now. Let's go back to the early days. You grew up in Detroit, Michigan. And a couple months before Pearl Harbor, Uncle Sam got a hold of you. How'd that happen?
Well, as your 21st birthday came along,
mm-hmm.
which was in April, you were put in the draft. So my number came up, I guess, somewhere in about June, I guess it was. I wasn't called till first part of October for the draft board. And of course, it was a foregone conclusion that I was going to be in the Army. I mean, it's automatic. I was single, no attachments, and it disrupted my life something fierce.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because no one exactly dreams of being drafted. Certainly, you had no idea that there would be a thing called D-Day and that you'd be rigging some parachutes and jumping with one on that day. But at that point, before you were drafted, what were you looking forward to? What were your ambitions?
Well, being a child of the Depression, and things were not good, you know, for anybody, if you're working for a living. I was rooming and boarding with a family, and he was Fred Diefendorf. He was a die setter for Firestone Tire Company in Wyandotte, Michigan. So he got me a job at Firestone.
Mm-hmm.
And I started out working as a punch press operator and just various things like that. You know, finally gotten a little money, and I got money I could afford to buy myself a car, which I did. 34 Ford two-door deluxe sedan. I paid $150 for it.
Those were the days.
Yeah. So by the time I got my draft, I was actually called to go to the Army. I was on my way to be, I was going to join the working force for real. You know, I had money in my pocket, you know, to spend and not worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
Had a nice car, this sort of thing, and things were looking good. And I halfway had a girlfriend. It just disrupted my what I thought life was going to be. That's all.
Rocked your world a little bit.
Yeah, I was going to. Well, it was going to be for 1 year, but that was an awful long time.
So you're drafted in October of 1941, and they said you're going to be in the military for 1 year.
Right.
Right. But 2 months later, something happened.
Yeah.
What do you remember about December 7th? Where were you? How'd you hear about it?
I was doing basic training at Camp Walters, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Town of Mineral Wells is the biggest town. We had got leave for the day or Sunday. We went to town and went to the movies. And I don't know what the picture was, so I don't remember that anymore. But anyway, we got out of the movies. We're going somewhere to get something to eat, I think. And somebody told us that Pearl Harbor had been bombed. Well, that turned everything upside down in a hurry. So, and of course, we immediately, everybody had to report back to the base for further what have you, mostly lockdowns, you know, this sort of thing. And then, of course, training began and really got busy at that time.
And did it hit you that 1 year commitment might be extended a little bit?
No, I really didn't think about it at the time. And of course, by that time, I had got oriented into the military way of life. And I was beginning to think, well, this isn't too bad for a, you know, for a single person.
Mm-hmm.
I had it in the back of my mind I was going to make a career of it. So anyway, there's a little story goes with this. I had a front tooth I broke before I went into service. Broke it in half.
How'd you do that?
I was working on my car, and I had a big old drop light draped on the drive shaft, and it fell down and hit me in the mouth.
Ouch.
So anyway, being a draftee, you weren't given too many goodies, so to speak, because it was temporary duty. So I had this broken tooth, and of course, I had to go to the dentist and all this sort of stuff to be checked out. And of course, the dentist says, "We got to take that tooth out because it's abscessed." I said, "Well, it doesn't bother me." I said, "It didn't hurt anything." Immediately, I thought, "Well, I'd seen other people. They took the tooth out, and that's left. That's it. Mm-hmm. They didn't fill the hole up."
Right.
I said, "No, you can't take my tooth out because I don't want the hole." While I was sitting there, the dentist was, the first lieutenant was talking about it. He had to go somewhere, and so he took off. And while I was sitting there waiting for him, in watched this breech boots World War I colonel.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to know, "Soldiers, what are you doing?" I said, "I'm here. My teeth worked on. They want to take my tooth out. And I don't want them to do it." And we got discussing about the Army, and told him, I said, "I'm thinking very seriously that I'm going to make a career out of the Army." And, of course, that really set him off. There's nothing better than for a young man to be in the military. Well, the upshot of the whole thing was, when the lieutenant came back from where he'd gone to, the first thing the colonel said, he told the lieutenant, he said, "Lieutenant, fix this man up with the best bridge in Ohio." And that was it. So I got a bridge replacement, and everybody that I knew couldn't understand how come I got a bridge and nobody else got one. And just because the colonel figured I was ripe to be for the Army.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it was about November. Troops came through from somewhere, and they were looking for volunteers. Well, number one, you don't volunteer in the Army.
I've heard so many veterans tell me that.
But I did.
But everybody breaks that rule. What's the deal?
Well, they came into the base, and they said they wanted volunteers to go through physical exercises and towards this sort of thing, and for 3 days. So I thought, okay, I'll try it, see what's going on. I had no idea what. They didn't say what they wanted. They just wanted to what your physical abilities were for.
Now, that's even worse than volunteering for something you know about. You volunteered for something you didn't even know what it was.
No, I didn't. So I took the 3 days training, and come to find out, you had to be doggone near an acrobat.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you got to be physically fit and pretty quick on your feet. So anyway, I took the test, and I think the last day I was there, this sergeant says to me, he says, "Next time wear your glasses." And I wore them intermittently. It didn't seem to make much difference at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And then he told me it's paratroopers. And, of course, that restarted an uproar when the rest of the troops, I think out of the whole base, I don't know how many thousands, they got 24 people.
Mm-hmm.
And I was one of the 24. We had to finish basic training, and the roll of the dice, the best thing I ever did.
Mm.
The troops that I was training with, which were all draftees, were the first troops in North Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And they got annihilated, basically.
And that would have been you?
Yeah.
Had you not volunteered?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that put me, 1941, 42, they gave me 2 more years stateside for mm-hmm. training with the paratroopers. We shipped overseas. We started in September of 43. It took us longer to get to Liverpool, England, than it took Columbus to get to the United States.
You guys were zigzagging a little bit, or what?
No. We were put on a British troop transport, which in its heyday would have been a luxury liner cruise ship between Liverpool, England, and Sydney, Australia. Of course, it had been really used hard, and the captain didn't want to leave New York because he said the ship wouldn't make it.
That's encouraging.
Anyway, he was right. We boarded that thing, and we went out. We sailed up north along the East Coast, up towards Labrador, that area. Mm-hmm. Again, about the second morning, I was sleeping on the upper deck. I couldn't stand to sleep down in the hold. Woke up, and I realized the ship was awful quiet. Nothing going on. It was foggy, real foggy. And about 10 o'clock that morning, the fog lifted, and here we sat dead in the water. And there was one destroyer circling us for protection. We were in Torpedo Alley.
Mm-hmm.
Not that time. They finally got the engines going again, and the closest place was St. John's, Newfoundland. So going into St. John's, it's a real narrow passage between two mountains.
Right.
And it's a kind of a dog-leg entrance from the ocean, and you can only go in and out at high tide because in that dog leg, there's a mountain in there. And if it wasn't high tide, you sure to knock the bottom out of your boat. And so we set out there and moved into St. John's, and I got a campaign ribbon for North American Defense because I was in the area for better than 30 days.
Not by design.
No, aborted transport ship. And we got off the ship, I think, once in harbor, do a little military work, and they tried to repair the ship. Well, they finally got it repaired, and we boarded the ship and headed out to sea. And as luck would have it, it wasn't quite high tide. We punched a hole in the bottom of the troop transport going out of the harbor. So we had to sit outside for 12 hours to get to high tide to get back in. So we got back in there, anchored to a buoy in the harbor. The ship was taken on water, this sort of thing. And to tell you how long we were there, there was a Navy troop transport in this convoy. Oh, by the way, the convoy was the first troops scheduled for the D-Day invasion.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in 44. But anyway, this Navy transport came back from Liverpool and picked us up at St. John's and took us to Liverpool. The Navy sailors were very unhappy because they all had tickets for the World Series in New York, and they missed the whole thing.
If you add it all up, how long did it take you to go from the States to England?
It took almost 44 days.
Wow. That's pretty close to a record.
Yeah.
You probably were pretty close to Columbus on that. Well, I know that once you did get across the pond, you had a very unique job. We need to take our first commercial break, but we're going to hear about Robert Barney's special job leading up to the D-Day invasion, why some of the other paratroopers depended on his work for whether they made it down safely or not. We'll explain that when Hometown Heroes continues next on KMJ.
It's as simple as ABC, Fresno T.
I can remember hearing that jingle on the radio for years, but I didn't really understand what it meant until redoing my shower a couple years ago. This is Paul Leffler, proud to welcome Fresno Distributing as a sponsor of Hometown Heroes here on KMJ. The knucklehead who tiled my shower, that would be yours truly, left a decent-sized hole around the shower arm. I needed an oversized flange to cover it, and I went all over town. None of the chain stores had what I needed. Finally, a merciful soul asked me, "Have you tried Fresno D?" Fresno D, as in duh, why didn't I think of that in the first place? So I quickly took the 41 of the McKinley exit, walked into Fresno Distributing, and bumped smack dab into the owner, Steve Cloud. He said he was sure they had exactly what I needed, and of course, he was right. Now I make Fresno D my first stop, whether I'm looking for one of those obscure plumbing parts or a top-of-the-line appliance, like the new Electrolux energy-efficient washer and dryer set my wife picked out. They have all the other top brands, too. Don't make the mistake I did. If you want your first stop to be your last stop, make a beeline for Fresno D. And while you're there, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes on KMJ. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis, its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We continue now with 92-year-old Robert Barney of Fresno, California, a veteran of the 101st Airborne during World War II. If you know anything about the Airborne, you have an idea of what that meant, and you've heard some recent Airborne veterans here on Hometown Heroes, but every story is unique. Every story is worth telling. We've heard about the misadventures of getting across to England. But once you're over there, now you are with an airborne division, the 101st. You're with a parachute infantry regiment, the 502nd. But you had a very specific job. How did that develop that you had the responsibility of rigging everybody's parachutes.
Well, we went through jump school at Fort Benning. Everything is planned out in advance. I mean, way in advance. So when I went through jump school, there was no such thing as 101st.
Right.
It was a parachute training battalion. Went through jump school, and we all graduated with our qualifying jumps. And they took everybody in the class just about that I was in, sent us to Chanute Field, Illinois.
All right.
To be parachute riggers. Of course, Chanute Field was the training for the Air Corps at that time, for mechanics, riggers, you name it. Flight engineers were all trained there at Chanute. And we were sent to Chanute to learn the basics of packing and repair and maintenance of parachutes. That was, I think, about 6 weeks we were there. And then we were sent back, and we went back to Fort Benning. And I was assigned to 502nd and put in service company as a parachute riggers, which we had to take care of parachutes and equipment for 101st Airborne, the whole division. And originally, they thought that each paratrooper could pack his own chute, but it was not possible because logistics and the time it took away from training to organize the chute packing details, they decided parachute riggers would be a company within the company, and we would do all the packing for all the paratroopers.
Right.
So that's what we did, because we could turn out, being we were proficient at packing chutes, I got to the point where I could pack about 10 chutes an hour.
And what does that entail, to pack a parachute that a paratrooper is going to use in combat? What do you have to do?
Well, the packing, what they call the packing sheds, they had these huge long wood tables, 30, 40 feet long, polished hardwood, and you stretch the parachute out on these tables, and there was a technique of folding the chute up, the canopy, into a nice, neat bundle, and you folded all this together and stuff it into the pack.
All right.
And, of course, then you had to sign off a card on it that you'd inspected and packed the chute. And every 30 days, and this was an Air Corps regulation, chutes had to be unpacked and repacked every 30 days.
To inspect them for safety?
Safety reasons. Mm-hmm. And, of course, at that time, parachutes were silk and cotton. Cotton was the harness, and silk was the canopies. And such thing was look for moths.
Right.
It couldn't be moth eaten.
Sure.
So this is...
A moth could cost somebody his life.
Yeah. So that's how that came about. We were to, like I say, maintain the chutes. And then it goes from there, and we also had a training program. That we were at Chilton Foliot, a little town in England, west of London. And so we run jump school for everybody. We had everything from privates to colonels.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a fun thing, telling some colonel what to do.
Here you are, a draftee,
yeah,
bossing a colonel around, huh?
Yeah. So,
did you feel a burden or a responsibility in packing those chutes that other men's lives were in your hands?
At first, it didn't register too much. And then I realized on training jumps, there was casualties. But then we realized that the casualties were mostly caused by people doing stupid things. But being that that was our job, you wouldn't have any malfunctions because of the chute itself. It was other things.
Mm-hmm.
And so then it began to sink in that, okay, that there's 8,000 guys here, more or less, depending what we do.
Absolutely.
So being that we had all this equipment, we had sewing machines of every kind you could think of, and we could the Air Corps taught us how to make things like engine covers for airplanes. And a little side issue come into here, then if people found out, especially the officers, that their uniforms didn't fit just right. So we got the job of tailoring uniforms on the side.
For a little extra change?
No.
Oh, out of duty.
Out of duty.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's before we even got overseas, we got into that. But consequently, because of our expertise, we probably had the finest dressed uniformed troops in the U.S. Army.
Well, they all had personal tailors at their beck and call.
That's right. We fit the uniform to fit the man.
You're over in England, and I'm sure it's registered in your mind that at some point you guys are heading across that channel and going into France. When did D-Day start for you? When did you realize that something was happening there?
Of course, it started a long time before D-Day.
Mm-hmm.
As a rigger, what I was basically trained as a combat soldier, paratrooper. So the training exercises, which we didn't know at the very beginning, was what the actual thing we were going to be doing when D-Day.
Mm-hmm.
Every place was figured out, and everybody was trained to do these operations. Surprisingly, it was probably the first time in military history that the buck private knew as much as the general what was going to happen.
Uh-huh.
The fact that everybody was trained for the job, and the fiasco that happened on D-Day, the troops being dispersed all over the country, and the fact that everybody knew what the total picture was, regardless of where they were near some place where they could be part. Would maybe the original mission,
right?
But you would be part of a mission to take the objectives that were planned on for D-Day.
So you feel like that training and the familiarity with the bigger picture maybe helped some guys deal with the chaos that comes from not landing where you were supposed to land.
That's right, because everybody knew what the whole story was, you know.
And you used the phrase first time in military history, and I think that's very relevant because no one had ever tried something like this before. There had never been that many parachutes in the sky on a mission, military-wise, in world history, as what you guys did that day. Did it hit you at all, the magnitude of what you guys were doing?
Not really. I don't know why. Usually, I think you're concerned about what you're doing at the present, whatever you're doing at the time. Get aboard the airplane. We had to get all our gear together, get it strapped on us, get in the airplane. And some of us had so much equipment they couldn't get in by themselves. Had to be helped. And this is, you know, everybody was overloaded.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was, I guess it wasn't until the shooting started that you realized that this is for real.
When, I'm guessing it was the early morning hours that you took off in the dark of night?
We took off before dark in England at that time was 11 o'clock at night.
Uh-huh.
And we took off somewhere 8, 9 o'clock in the evening.
So D-Day for you started on June 5th, not June 6th.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
So, and of course, if anybody knew what they looked at the invasion, the airborne, they took off from England, flew out toward over the Atlantic just about, and they swung east to hit Normandy Peninsula from the west side,
mm-hmm.
from the ocean side. And of course, it was laid out that way that the airplanes would go across the drop zones, and they'd already be headed for England. So there was no turning around or...
Right.
Just one shot deal, one straight run. And of course, the idea was, it was a great idea, but human nature being what it is, didn't work that way.
Mm-hmm.
When the shooting started, a lot of the pilots flying the troop ships had just stuck the nose down, opened the throttles, and made a run for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then give you a green light to get out the door.
Whether they were where they were supposed to be or not.
Yeah.
Sidetrack for a second. How many, what's your estimate of the guys jumping that day? How many of those guys do you think had their chutes personally packed by you?
I never thought about it.
You think we're talking dozens? You think we're talking hundreds?
I suppose if you take, of course, but how many times I pack chutes? Like I say, that every 30 days we had to repack them.
Right.
So, you know, we had to go, like I said, I could put 10 an hour out if I put my mind to it.
Yeah.
And that's just did it.
So there were quite a few guys jumping that day, and had packed their chutes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So what happened for you? Where were you guys, and when did you get that green light? It's go time, and you're heading down into that sky over France.
Well, I was completely off the map, so to speak. It was way south of where I was supposed to be.
Uh-huh.
Like I say, that usually you could put 24-man stick on an airplane in the infield of a wall diamond. But this case was the high speed— And we're scattered a long ways apart. And I don't know, I didn't see anybody where I landed, just me and a bunch of cows. So, you know, I got on my chute, put my rifle together, and started walking. I knew I had to go north, because that's where the action was supposed to be. Eventually met up a few people here and there, finally wound up back on the Normandy beaches, so to speak, where we belonged.
Okay, so you're describing this, and you lived it, so I understand it's not that shocking to you, but I'm imagining myself in your shoes. You've never done this before.
No.
You've never jumped into combat before.
No.
You're all of 24 years old. You jump out of an airplane thinking you might be somewhere near the rest of your guys, but you come down all alone, not knowing if there's enemy out there, what you're going to find in the middle of the night. To me, that's a pretty scary situation. What was going through your mind?
I was hoping I wouldn't find anybody I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
But the order came down that we were not to fire our rifles. In other words, any firing was going on, the enemy was doing it.
Right.
And why we couldn't fire back, I don't know. That didn't make sense, but you got to protect yourself.
Right. You'd rather fire your weapon than die, right? Yeah.
We had these little, what they call crickets, these little clickers.
Uh-huh.
And that was our means of identification after we landed. And I forget what the numbers were, but anyway.
So many clicks of that cricket, and then someone else knew that it was friendly.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So is that how you encountered some?
Yeah. I suppose by daylight, I think there was a half a dozen of us finally got together. And we weren't, none of us knew anybody else.
You never met each other before? You're all from separate planes?
We're from separate airplanes.
Yeah.
Separate troops. And that was it, you know.
Did any of you know where you were?
We had an idea.
Uh-huh.
Like I said, I knew where I was, that I had to go north to where our drop zone was supposed to have been.
Right.
And that was the whole thing involved there. Luckily, from 1 o'clock in the morning till daylight, we didn't meet anybody or anything. We were that far away from the action, just a crapshoot.
I guess so. In retrospect, would you say that you were scared?
Oh boy. Yes, huh. I was scared, and I didn't get scared till after I hit the ground. It's a lonely world out there.
I would imagine it could be a little overwhelming.
Yeah, but being at, I think, the average individual at Yankee Ingenuity, you had a job that we're supposed to do, and it was over there somewhere, so you start headed for it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it worked out.
All right. You were one of the first planes to have guys jump behind enemy lines. You guys were going there early because, again, part of your specific purpose, not only do you have a gun and you're going to be fighting the enemy, but you were supposed to retrieve the chutes of other paratroopers?
Yeah.
How was that supposed to work?
I don't know. Well, being in the rigger section, I don't know how many of us were picked out of the rigger section at that time. I don't know, half a dozen of us, I guess, or so. And we were just shoved into a group, just individually. I forget the plane load of troops I was in, what their objective was. But my job was, all of the riggers, we were supposed to gather up all these chutes, put them in a bag, and pile them somewhere so they could be picked up and retrieved.
Mm-hmm.
Being that I was an outsider, I didn't count. That's the way things are. You know, I mean, you train with a group of people, and you know them inside out.
Right.
Your family.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't train with not one of these people.
Right.
And I was just an add-on to pick things up.
And then when you land all by yourself with no one in sight, there aren't any other chutes to pick up.
No.
And you described being frightened, being scared, and really feeling that once you hit the ground. So then as you did meet up with some more troops and you move toward where you think you're supposed to be, what was that first moment where you encountered the enemy or you got a real first taste of combat circumstances?
Oh, it was, I guess it was on D-Day, and it was late. We finally got, we were organized somewhat into units. We got into a firefight with some troops. Never saw them. Anyway, they run onto us, I guess, or something. We traded shots back and forth, and finally, I guess they decided that it was the wrong place to be, so they left. Well, I say this, after on D-Day, when I run across my first dead German, and somebody had been there before me. Anyway, this is a young fellow. I suppose he was my age. And, of course, we were in training. We were the best damn troopers in the world,
mm-hmm.
bar none. We could beat everybody, including Patton's 2nd Armored Division.
Mm-hmm.
So this was, you were indoctrinated. That was part of the training.
Right.
That you were better than anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And you could do it. But run across this fellow who had been killed, and I looked at him laying there, and Somebody had emptied his pockets and left his billfold and what have you, just laying on his chest. And I looked at that stuff, and he had a family, children. And that's when I realized they weren't monsters. They were people like me. They were doing what they were supposed to do, and there was no animosity involved in it. I mean, there was, but that wasn't the that. And that's when I became a very reluctant soldier, that these people were just like I am. So my combat experience, when I was called on to do something, I did the best I could and hoped for the best, and here I am.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it almost sounds like what you're saying is that when you saw that dead German soldier, you almost saw yourself in a different uniform.
Yeah.
And that stuck with you.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure that's going to stick with our listeners, too. It's time for another brief break, but when we come back, the rest of Robert Barney's story. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on KMJ. Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while, so next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today jumped behind enemy lines on D-Day, June 6, 1944. Robert Barney survived that with the 502nd Parachute Infantry Regiment of the 101st Airborne. We're going to hear about some of the other things he survived. If he hadn't, he never would have met his wife of nearly 66 years, Dorothy. He wouldn't have spent 32 years at Edwards Air Force Base working for companies like Northrop Aircraft and General Electric. I'm sure we could fill another program with some of those stories. Every veteran and has a little different twist on what helped him endure the challenges of World War II. When we left off, Mr. Barney had shared the impact of seeing a dead young German soldier, and that moment and others like it affected his mindset moving forward.
Another thing that evolved from that, you never got too close to anybody.
Uh-huh.
No buddy-buddy stuff.
Because you knew there's a good chance
somebody
wasn't coming home.
Yeah.
How often did you think about the odds against you? The chances that you might not come home?
Well, I never really pursued that. I think I took it one day at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose a lot of guys did the same thing I did. There's the hellfire and brimstone soldiers that just eat that stuff up. I don't begrudge them what they did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that whatever I did, it was part of my job, and I forgot it as quickly as I could.
Mm.
And when I was discharged, the service did not exist. What I did was, that was it.
When you got to the point where you understood the D-Day invasion as a whole, you understood the role that the airborne played in it, and you understood the heavy losses that airborne units took that day, what did that bring to mind for you? What did that do to you?
Well, it bothered me because I knew a lot of them, not real close. We knew people, and this one got killed, that one got killed. I don't know. I think I just shut my mind to it.
Hmm.
I mean, that wasn't part of the deal, I guess. I guess I've been that way most of my life, really, that I don't get too close to people. I don't know why.
Well, I think everyone appreciates you sharing a little bit of your story with us here today. You said you take things one day at a time. June 6th, of course, is famously known as the longest day, but you had a lot of days in the 101st. I'm sure some of those days were tougher than others. Do you look back and remember some real close calls where it easily could have been you?
Oh, yeah. There's a few places, instances, usually, like I say, in a big battle, so to speak. What people do 200 yards from you, you know nothing about.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what you're doing.
If you are worried about it, you're probably not going to survive that battle.
Could be.
Yeah. You know,
so it people say, well, this happened. Or I don't remember a lot of this stuff because I wasn't quite there. I might have been there, but not right there.
Right.
So that's the way I operated, I guess. I just lucked out.
I look at your board of medals here, and I recognize the Bronze Star, which I'm going to bug you about, the Combat Infantry Badge, of course. You got your parachute wings there and the airborne patch. And what I don't see there is a Purple Heart. How close did you come to picking one of those up? What do you remember as the time that you came to
that one?
Well, you better.
The only time that I got hurt was in Normandy. And this was when things were progressing like they were supposed to. And we had, you know, everybody has a little spare time on their hands, so to speak. We decided, the group, we needed a little entertainment and a little boost.
Uh-huh.
So I was delegated to get on my motorbike and see if I could find some. I went looking for, I finally found a cafe or what have you in little town near where we were on the Normandy Peninsula. I had some stuff that the other guys had given me to trade. So I went into this cafe and see what I could get. Somebody gave me a pair of old GI shoes and other stuff. The guy that owned the bar, run the bar, whatever I had, he wasn't interested outside of the shoes. So we made a deal, and he gave me this little cask of whiskey, about five gallons or so of whiskey.
Sounds like enough.
So anyway, it was Calvados, French Calvados. And Calvados comes in under many headings. Usually it's an apple brandy type thing.
Uh-huh.
And where we were in the Champagne Valley area of France, it was grapes. And they made their Calvados out of what was left over pressing the grapes.
Uh-huh.
And that stuff was the wickedest I've ever drank in my life. You could drink that stuff, and it could affect you the strangest ways. Some guys would be drunk from the waist up. Other guys drunk from the waist down. They couldn't walk. And if you drank anything with it the next morning, you were right back where you started from.
Uh-huh.
God, it was vicious stuff. Wow. Anyway, when I come back with that booze run, we were right close to an armored division. They had been crossing the road, this blacktop road, with their tanks. And, of course, it gravel covered the road. And I was whizzing through there on my motorbike, and I hit this loose gravel, and down I went. Didn't bust the barrel, thankfully, but I cracked an ankle. The tankers picked me up, first aid, and took off my boot, taped me up real good, put my boot back on, then I was recommended for a Purple Heart for breaking my ankle.
On a booze run.
On a booze run. So I refused to take it. I thought, there's got to be more to it than this.
I think that's an honorable choice. Were there times where something a little more sinister came close to hurting you? Perhaps enemy fire or artillery that...
Yeah, I went through... Oh, when I broke my ankle that same night, we went through the artillery barrage. For some reason, our regimental surgeon decided there was nothing wrong with me. So anyway, they took this tape off my ankle and shot me with morphine. Now, that's an experience. It wasn't about 30 minutes or so after the artillery barrage started, and this morphine started to take effect. And it seemed like I grew bigger and bigger and bigger until I was the biggest damn thing in the world. And I literally got my rifle and went hunting, shoot up everything. Never got a scratch.
Wow.
People said they'd hollering at me to get down. No, I was going to fight war. That was the worst one because I didn't know what was going on.
Yeah, and you talk about putting yourself in harm's way. You're really asking for it in a situation like that. Yeah. Somebody must have been looking out for you.
Yeah.
So the D-Day operation, and most of the airborne veterans that I've talked to also participated in Operation Market Garden, the drop into Holland.
Yeah.
Is that something you were part of?
Yeah, it was still the same situation. We were assigned to pick up parachutes.
Uh-huh.
The riggers again.
Right.
But for some reason, that only lasted about 3 or 4 days, I think. We were told to get transportation back to England our own. We rode POW trucks, guarding prisoners, going to the channel, this sort of thing.
And what was that like for you? Because you described how moving it was for you to encounter that first German soldier who was dead. Now you're riding these trucks with German prisoners. Did you have any kind of interactions with them at all?
I didn't too much. My buddy here, Marvin Feldman, he let him know he was a Jew. Oh, Lord. He rubbed it in something fierce. And, of course, they couldn't do anything. And luckily, they aboard the truck, there were several German officers.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no enlisted men. And, of course, they couldn't do anything. I mean, they were highly put out about the situation, but they had to take what they got.
Right. And then for most airborne veterans in World War II, the next big event that they were involved in was not something they necessarily jumped into, but were trucked into at the Battle of the Bulge. Did you avoid that, or were you stuck there freezing your rear end off too?
I got part of it.
What happened?
I think about it, and it's all I know is cold, 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 cold. Miserable. I was attached to this unit or that unit or what, you know, for whatever purposes we had to do. You know, I wouldn't say it was any clear-cut vision at all to me.
You didn't really know what you were doing?
No.
Other than trying to survive?
That's it.
How hard was that? What was the enemy worse or the weather?
The weather was the worst. You could handle the enemy. You know what you could do with him. But the weather, you couldn't do anything about.
And this is a boy from Detroit who's seen plenty of winters.
Yeah.
But this was a little worse?
That was probably the worst winter. I think that was the worst winter in 50 years that they'd ever seen in that part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
England was really hard hit. That was really day by day, whatever you could do to go on.
And to spell it out for people who weren't there or aren't familiar with the Battle of the Bulge, where did you get to sleep? How did you try to stay warm? What was it like just making it from one day to the next?
Well, you had the clothes on your back, and once in a while it'd be a building you'd get into or something, you know, and stay out of the worst of it. But otherwise, it was just eternally froze. Damn, that's what I remember most about anything is the horrible, horrible cold. I've been reading these books about other people, other outfits. My God. I lived it great compared to some people.
In terms of the losses?
Losses, especially POWs that finished the war in POW camps.
Mm-hmm. That said, while the bulge was going on and you were involved, did you ever wonder if you would make it to the next day?
Yeah, but I don't think it was in the back of your mind, but it was not something you really dwelled on. You don't dwell on this kind of things, at least I don't. I just think whatever's going to happen is going to happen, and nothing to do about it.
And I would guess when you're in a situation like that, combat situation with awful weather where that poses a bigger risk to your life as enemy fire does, that once it's finally over, there's a fair amount of relief that you experience. Do you remember when it finally ended for you?
Yeah, it was a nice day. The sun was shining. The troop transports were coming to resupplies. And, of course, good old Patton showed up. Just a big relief.
And what happened for you from there? Because there's still a few more months of the war in Europe, but did you get to come home, or what did they do with
you? No.
You wish, huh?
Our commanding general was Maxwell D. Taylor. And if anybody loved to fight more than he did, we called him Mission Maxwell. He was always looking for a mission for the troops. Apparently, he conceived the idea that his division was going to have their own victory parade in New York City. So the war ended in Europe. We didn't do anything. And all these young troops were, a lot of them no combat time at all, being shipped home here. And we're sitting there, and couldn't figure out what was going on. So I guess the general decided that he was going to have his own victory parade in New York. So he tried to hide us, I guess you might say. Some other GI decided to go to Inspector General about it. Why are we sitting here? Combat troops, matter of fact, and the war was over in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And here we sit.
You're still there into the fall of 45.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, they blew the whistle on that one. And of course, we were rapidly busted up and shipped out with the 24th Infantry or something I was with. So I wasn't shipped home with the 101st.
So the idea was, as you understand it, the general wanted to keep you guys in Europe longer so that when you finally came home, it wouldn't be muddled up with everything else and there would be a big reason to celebrate.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not how it worked out.
No, I guess he didn't have enough to pull it off.
You don't sound too disappointed, though.
No, because when it was over, I immediately, that was it. I mean, did I what I was supposed to do?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not the best of my ability, but whatever I could. When it was over, it was over. That was it. Forget it. Go on. Go home.
And what did it feel like for you to come home, to get back on American soil again?
It was pretty doggone nice. Except the early troops, I guess, that came back, you know, they were treated pretty fair. But by the time I got back, hey, let's get this show on the road. Let's mm-hmm. get it over with. A lot of guys we'd heard had hauled stuff home that were, you know, whatever they get accumulated over in Europe, they let them keep it. The time we got home, they made sure you didn't have anything that it wasn't issued to you. That mm-hmm. was it.
So you had a lot of souvenirs confiscated.
Well, I lost those. I acquired a bunch of stuff in Normandy. Of course, when we get ready for Holland, this sort of stuff, you had to pack up all your gear, and the quartermaster come and picked it up and supposedly stored it for you till you got back. Well, I had my barracks bag was full of stuff that I had gotten in Normandy. I had a artillery officer's dress uniform that I acquired, and a bunch of other stuff. And when I got my barracks bag back from the quartermaster, all that was left in it was a field jacket and a pair of shoes.
Something tells me those souvenirs came home with someone else instead of with you.
So, and of course, what bothered me the most, because I had all the, especially from Normandy, all the maps, aerial photos and stuff of what we're supposed to do. That was all that. I saved all that stuff. And of course, that was all gone.
All gone.
So that said no more souvenirs. So
of course, you had it all in your memory, and I can tell you still do. But when you got home, I imagine it was pretty meaningful for you to see your family again after being overseas for so long.
Yeah, it was. It was great, but being me, I was a footloose guy. I didn't stick around long.
Well, it's probably a good thing you didn't, because you had to meet your wife, and that's something. I know the first time I met you was at the VA, and I was there giving a talk, and I shared about my grandfather famously, in my world, telling me that I wouldn't be here if he hadn't survived World War II. And in your case, you've got two kids and three grandkids and three great-grandkids who wouldn't be here because you never would have met your wife.
That's right.
How did that happen? You met in a bar?
Yeah. I get these ideas in my head. I do stupid things like everybody does, you know.
We sure do.
So I was living with my aunt and uncle in Compton, and they were getting tired of me, to tell you the truth. So this is one Saturday. I decided I was going to go up Pacific Boulevard, hit every bar on both sides of the street, and I did.
You weren't riding a motorbike, were you?
No, I was driving a car.
All right.
Oh, only had one door on it.
Close enough, then.
I was working with it in a body shop.
Uh-huh.
And I had this Pontiac coupe, and the floorboards were rusted out. So the guy that owned it was helping me repair it. So anyway, the left-hand door was off. So the time I got to Huntington Park, I was feeling no pain, no problems whatsoever. And I went into this bar called the Alibi Room. And I'm sitting with my back to the door at the bar. It was kind of cool. And I know sometime in the evening, I felt the cold air on my back. And here in walked these two girls. One of them was long-legged, fur coat. And that's the first thing I saw.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Dorothy with her sister.
Uh-huh.
And I offered to take them home. And Dorothy had a fit riding in that car with no door on it.
Can you blame her?
No. But that, you know, things like that didn't mean anything.
Uh-huh. Well, with a start like that, you were destined for being married 66 years this August, right?
God, I guess so.
How long did you wait before you asked her to marry you?
It wasn't long. 3 months.
When you think about that, with all the time that's passed, I mean, here, you're still married to the same woman 66 years later, and you've got 2 children and 3 grandkids and 3 great-grandchildren. Do you ever allow yourself to think, wow, how different things would have been if it was you who landed wrong in that parachute or you that took the bullet instead of a buddy?
That didn't enter into it. What got into my mind was what I would have been if I hadn't met her.
Mm-hmm.
That was the thing that really got me.
What kind of answers did you come up with?
I'd have been a bum.
Huh.
Because, you know, I just go here, go there, you know, that's what I did. My father was a footloose person also. And I guess if I hadn't met her, I have no idea where I'd been. I had no ambitions that I know of. She's the one that got me to go back to school. Otherwise, I have no idea what it had been like.
So Uncle Sam had you for 4 years as a paratrooper, but it took Dorothy to get you to straighten up and fly right, huh?
Sure did.
When you think back about what you did in World War II, and I know that you don't want to draw attention to yourself and you're not looking for any glory, but I see a bronze star there. How'd you end up with that?
I didn't even know I had it. I didn't even know I had it.
When'd you find out?
Well, you know, you got the campaign ribbons there that everybody you wore.
Right.
Well, the basis of that, the campaign ribbons, took the place of the medals. Like, you know, you see the foreigners, the Russians, or they get medals to held for breakfast all over them, you know.
Right.
And we had the campaign ribbons and made it much simpler. And so I don't know what started. I guess I decided that maybe the kids might be interested in what I had. So I wrote to the Army, to St. Louis, for the medals.
Uh-huh.
And lo and behold, I come back and I get the Bronze Star. So don't ask me why I got it. So that's why I say everybody got a Bronze Star.
So they didn't send you a citation or a write-up. They just sent you the medal.
I didn't know what I did to get it.
Well, when you think back on all of it, all those days that you endured as a paratrooper, certainly those bitterly cold days at the Battle of the Bulge, when you think back on all of it, what are you most thankful for and what are you most proud of?
Surviving. You know, you look at that's the part when you think about what took place, all these guys that made it home like I did, that was an accomplishment.
Mm-hmm.
We survived. And like I said, when the job was done, I did not participate. I never gave it a thought. Matter of fact, I was in Holland when I was working with General Electric.
Mm-hmm.
We were doing some flight test work, and we were staying in a Holiday Inn in Eindhoven, and all the floors were named for paratrooper units.
Huh.
I never even thought about it. I thought, you know, oh, okay. You know, that these people see things different than what I do, or what most people do, I guess.
I bet that made you feel appreciated.
Yeah, and we weren't that far away from, you know, the bridge too far.
Mm-hmm.
I never went to any of these places. I had no desire to.
Hmm.
Why? I don't know.
Well, maybe that focusing ahead instead of behind is part of your secret to being so sharp and so in shape at age 92. I just want to thank you for serving our country, let you know that we here in Central California appreciate what you and your fellow soldiers did, the same way they apparently do over there in the Netherlands. And we're grateful you're willing to reflect back on some of your experiences here on the program. If you at home would like to see what Mr. Barney looks like or access the podcast version with a few extra stories that wouldn't fit into our time today, go to the Hometown Heroes section at kmjnow.com. That's it for now, but we'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.
Is there anything that I haven't asked you about that you think is important for us to know about World War II and what you and guys like you did?
I don't think so. I think it's been said.
Do you think people today understand it? Understand what the world was like and what the job you had to do was?
Well, the older people do.
Well, help us younger folks out. Why was it so important to do what you did?
I guess the younger people have to look at Vietnam, and the rest of it, which was senseless, and George Bush's war, senseless. Oh, that's what they see. They didn't live where everybody, I don't care, you name it. Well, there was the black marketeers and the people that made their bucks by this. But everybody was fighting the war. I don't care where they were, mm-hmm. in their own little way. And they were sincere about it.
So the unity that you felt in the United States then is something.
That was it. There was no question what was involved and what had to be done. And so you just got with it, did it.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you a little story about Patton.
All right, let's hear it.
Well, Patton had picked out the Palm Springs area. It was, I don't know, thousands of square miles of desert.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they were training for North Africa. They were looking for means to keep Patton supplied. Being an airborne, they thought, okay, we'll supply him by the air. We had no outside of kicking air bundles out the door of an airplane and chute opening and hoping for the best, you know, mm-hmm. which they developed to us later on to a real degree. So we were sent there to try this out. It just never materialized because it, I don't know why. I saw Patton a few times, and he had a quarter mile of a road in front of his camp and don't even let a dog get on that road when he's making his morning walk. And that's why, you know, when you were armored, you wore your sleeves buttoned at the cuff,
mm-hmm.
the neck was buttoned at the top, you wore your steel helmet at all times, regardless of what the temperature was.
Because otherwise you'd hear it from him.
Oh. He was nasty, but he overdid it. But the idea behind it was not to take care of the troops. And of course, when we were there, invariably, there was a plane load of tankers went to Los Angeles and Hollywood every weekend when they could do it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he provided some entertainment, but I mean, when he was running the show, he was running the show.
Mm-hmm.